Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn how the residents of one local community struck a compromise in an effort to preserve their rural way of life. We'll also explore the issue of elder abuse in California and why so much of it goes unreported. Plus, Jim Boren joins us to talk about his new Institute for Media and Public Trust at Fresno State. And we talk with author Steve Yarborough, whose new novel is out and is set in part in the Valley. That's all on the way later this hour. We begin our program, though, today in Bakersfield. California is the third largest oil producer in the country, and Kern County leads the way here in the Golden State. As we speak, almost 81,000 wells across California are churning out oil and gas or being used to inject wastewater back into the ground. For every three of those wells, however, there's another well that's not doing any of those things. Idle wells. They can deteriorate and contaminate the air and water over the long term, even while they're sitting silent. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports on a new state law targeting those idle wells, and she begins in Kern County.
When you picture an oil company CEO, Chad Hathaway is probably not who comes to mind. The father of three looks young. He's built like a football player. He has the energy of a college student. And he started his company, Hathaway LLC, shortly after graduating.
I started the company from scratch. I borrowed $5,000 from my mom, who was a school teacher.
Now he operates a few hundred wells in Kern County. He takes me to some on a sandy, scrubby plot of land in the Fruitvale oil field just outside Bakersfield. He points to a handful of oil derricks dipping down and up and down.
We got one, two, three, and then four, which you can't see over there, are active wells.
And then to a few metal valves jutting out of the ground.
And one, two, three idle wells on this property.
Idle wells. They're not active wells, currently producing oil, but they're not permanently plugged and abandoned either. That would involve filling them with heavy mud and cement so they could never be tapped again. Hathaway says idle wells are in limbo, ready to be reactivated if they can turn a profit.
It all depends on the price of oil.
In fact, after oil prices plummeted in 2014, the number of idle wells jumped by 10%. Some wells lay idle for decades, so capping them is a careful business.
You know, as you see, these wells are heavily bolted up and sealed off. That wellhead can withstand 3,000 pounds.
But nothing is foolproof. California has nearly 29,000 idle wells, and they can be risky, environmentally and financially. Even minor leaks of oil or gas could have a lingering impact on groundwater and air quality. That's why a new state law tightens idle well regulations. It aims to reduce the number of idle wells over time and to detect structural problems earlier. And although Hathaway doesn't agree with every provision of the law, he says generally it's a good idea.
So you take the environmental concerns pretty seriously?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're in California, and not just that, but you know, we live here and this is my community, these are my friends, these are my neighbors.
For a few months in 2016, an idle well in Bakersfield leaked a bubbling mix of fluid and steam. A few years earlier, an earthquake disrupted an idle well in Ojai. It leaked as much as 5 barrels of water per minute for months. But blowouts like these are extremely rare. In the southern San Joaquin Valley in the 90s and early 2000s, less than 2% of blowouts were from idle wells. Still, Stanford Earth scientist Rob Jackson says the risk is high enough to make plugging them worthwhile, especially because almost a fifth are at least 20 years old.
The longer they sit, kind of unused and unattended, the more likely you are to have a problem.
California's oldest has been idle since 1899. But small-scale leaks can pose problems, too. Civil engineer Mary Kang of Canada's McGill University studies emissions from abandoned wells, which, unlike idle wells, should be permanently sealed. And yet, In Pennsylvania, she found that over time, small leaks from abandoned wells became a significant source of the greenhouse gas methane.
If you just look at the rate per year, it's relatively small compared to active wells. However, there is evidence to show that they have been emitting for a long time.
Over two-thirds of California's 29,000 idle wells are in the San Joaquin Valley. Many are located in neighborhoods and near schools. The largest owners, no surprise, are mega producers Chevron and Aera. The law, Assembly Bill 2729, forced new rules on oil and gas operators. Starting in January, it gave them a choice: either pay an annual fee per idle well or plug and abandon a fraction each year. David Bunn is director of the California Department of Conservation, which oversees the oil and gas regulating agency known as DOGGR.
It's the industry being accountable for the liability of the idle wells that they have, and to seriously evaluate, are they, you know, if they don't have plans to use those wells again, then they should go ahead and plug and abandon properly.
The law increases bonding requirements, too, so that if a company goes out of business, the state won't get saddled with taking care of its wells. Since 1977, DOGGR has spent $30 million plugging so-called orphaned wells. Rock Zierman, CEO of the California Independent Petroleum Association, agrees it's important to minimize the risks of idle wells, but he worries the financials could break some smaller producers.
It considerably increases the cost of doing business in California.
But to Bill Alio of the nonprofit organization Environmental Working Group, EB 2729 is a welcome change. He says this and a few related bills mark a new era for the regulating agency DOGGR, which he felt used to be too cozy with the industry.
Music to my ears. After looking at DOGGR for these years and seeing how little they were getting done in terms of regulating the oil industry, here was DOGGR saying, you know what? We're going to start doing a better job of enforcement.
In Bakersfield, Chad Hathaway agrees AB 2729 is a change of pace for the state oil and gas regulator.
You kind of put some legislative teeth behind it, more so than what was before under just the Public Resources Code.
Though, unlike Alio, he doesn't think DOGGR was ever too close to the industry in the first place. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
The city of Clovis has a reputation for good schools, walking trails, and upscale neighborhoods. It's also one of California's faster-growing cities. People want to live there. So, as the city grows, pressure is also growing for developers to add new homes, often converting farmland to subdivisions. So how do rural residents there coexist with new development while keeping their country way of life? Reporter Mark Benjamin explains how one neighborhood is adapting to change.
On the northern edge of Clovis is a neighborhood that remains part of the county. People here live beside orchards, raise animals, and get water from their wells. It's called the Dry Creek Preserve. It's about 800 acres wedged between exclusive neighborhoods about a mile east of the highly touted Buchanan High School. For Dale Mitchell and 240 other property owners, it's a rural paradise they don't want changing.
Sometimes I can call them with a cowbell. Mm-hmm. My wife rings a cowbell. I mean, we can do that. This time of day, they're likely to be pretty lazy.
Mitchell farms pecans across this quarter-mile-long plot of land. The whistle and bell ringing you hear is for his herd of Peruvian pack mules. They're known for sweaters and spitting. Yes, llamas. A handful of them suspiciously eye unfamiliar visitors to get to their food. A few feet away, Mitchell also has peacocks that let out an occasional ear-splitting squawk. Mitchell and his neighbors want to keep this way of life, but realize development is closing in. They want to have a say in the way new housing tracts are built.
High-density development is not going to be compatible with the rural environment.
Now, after years of sometimes tense negotiations, Mitchell and his neighbors have a breakthrough deal. It will allow Mitchell and his neighbors to continue farming, keep their well, and unusual farm animal menageries, even if this rural enclave is annexed to the city. This rural lifestyle has some history. Around 1900, the area was part of a huge wheat field owned by Clovis Cole. He was known as America's Wheat King and is also the city's namesake.
It was part of the dry land wheat farming operation of Clovis Cole. Dry Creek is over here about a quarter mile to the west of us. And he had most of the land tied up in wheat farming to the west of Dry Creek and some to the east.
In the 1960s, the land was subdivided into large plots that allowed farming and a rural way of life to continue. By 1988, the city started talking about bringing Dry Creek Preserve into the city limits. Residents refused. Brian Araki, Clovis City Planner, recalls those days and the reactions of residents.
They were saying, we don't want to be a part of the city. Well, you know, we don't need a plan for us. We're okay.
They refused again in 1993 and 2009. By then, the residents wanted some city protection because home builders were making plans for their area without them. The county area is surrounded by Clovis. Residents rely on the city because it has a say in all development nearby. And even though Mitchell and his neighbors don't want to be in the city, they want to preserve their way of life. They also want developers to consider their needs, too. Araki said developers came and went.
There had been property owners and developers coming in and talking to us about potential for development, what's the land worth out there.
In the meantime, Mitchell was preparing. He used his background as a state fish and wildlife supervisor to write a plan for residents to retain their property rights and not get overrun by city folk. Most developers were finding projects too costly, especially after the city told builders they had to get buy-in from Dry Creek Preserve residents. That meant fewer homes and less profit. Woodside Homes showed up in 2015. Matt Smith was assembling 45 acres across 8 chunks of property for the company. Then came the hard part, working with the Dry Creek Preserve neighbors. City planner Brian Araki recalled that Smith and Mitchell got off to a bumpy start.
Matt Smith and Dale got together. They were, you know, rivals at the first commission meeting, and Dale was passionate that he didn't want this project to move forward.
But Smith wasn't going away. After 2 years of meetings and multiple revisions, Woodside Homes, the residents, and the city were able to hammer out a compromise. This is Matt Smith of Woodside Homes.
My feelings on it really evolved over time, which was at first we started looking at it as a project, and then it became more nuanced, and we realized that there were a lot of neighbors who had strong feelings for their land and wanted to keep them, preserve their land.
That led to Woodside, the residents, and the city striking a deal. The two-part compromise brings Dry Creek Preserve into the city with all the rights residents had while living in the county. It also allows Woodside to build houses, but under conditions agreed to by residents and the city. That means fewer homes on larger lots. Future developments will have to follow a similar path.
We know we have to make money on it. We know we have to spread the cost over a certain amount of lots, but how low of a density can we do it and still make money?
Last week, after 3 years, Clovis City Council approved annexing the Dry Creek Preserve and allowing Woodside's housing tract. There were concerns about traffic and opposition from two residents, but more than a dozen others agreed to the protections to allow farming, limit the number of homes, and reduce lighting that will give new development that rural feel and better blend with Dry Creek Preserve. Dry Creek Preserve resident Tom Bell worked on the agreements with Mitchell. He told the Clovis City Council the process wasn't always easy.
There's been trials and tribulations. There's been frustration by everybody. But the bottom line is, I think that we've reached an agreement in the annexation agreement where we have protected all of our residents' rights.
A few technical issues still need to be ironed out at the county level, but the biggest hurdles between the city, developer, and the residents are mostly gone. And Mitchell thinks it was a fair outcome for his neighborhood and future generations of Clovis residents.
We'll be preserving the rural, you know, rural environment and the rural character, and hopefully be able to hang on to some of the agriculture, since that's a part of the roots of the city of Clovis. We just hate to see that loss.
For Valley Public Radio in Clovis, this is Mark Benjamin.
Amid talk of fake news and alternative facts, last week Fresno State took a step to address the issue of media literacy. The university launched a new Institute for Media and Public Trust.
Its leader, Jim Boren, longtime editor of the Fresno Bee, joins us right now to talk more about the Institute and what it means. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Joe.
In your multi-year tenure, multi-decade tenure with the Fresno Bee, you saw a lot of changes in the newspaper industry, in the media overall. This idea of public trust in the media, how did you see that evolve to the point we are now and where we need something like this institute?
Well, I think over the years, there's always been that certain amount of mistrust. But in that era of social media, it kind of just gets amplified a lot more. And after the 26th election, it kind of got on steroids. And it's been something I've been thinking about even before that election as editors. I've fielded calls from readers. And I knew that there was a trust gap between our readers sometimes and what we do. And I always wanted to find a way to bridge that gap, let people sit down and talk about the issues and challenges, be more transparent in media, and listen to the kinds of conversations that our readers had and the questions they had about how and why we do things.
Aside from the macro-level debates about fake news and those sorts of things and what's going on at the national level, let's take it down to, in an abstract sense, the local level. As an editor, how hard is it to rebuild trust when something happens that may, for whatever reason, be perceived negatively in the community? Media organizations pride themselves on their objectivity, on their ability to maintain that public trust. How significant is that from your perspective as somebody who led a major media organization here in the Valley?
It's always a challenge. I think in the long history of the Fresno Bee, 96 years, you know, we have been a trusted voice in the San Joaquin Valley. That doesn't always mean that people believed us. Some people thought we had a political agenda in our news coverage, and that's never going to go away. I welcome people's calls. If they want to have a conversation with me, I would have that conversation. I'd have a 20-minute conversation if they wanted to talk about it. If they wanted to rant, I would listen to them. But I think when people, you know, listen, and we listen to what their concerns are, we can bridge that gap. The problem is you can't spend 20 minutes with every reader or every listener to a radio station or viewer on a television station. So what we want to do with this Media Institute is try to make this scalable and find some best practices and bring people in, experts in the field, listen to readers, listen to others who have some ideas and look for solutions.
So I want to ask how you do that, but before we get there, this idea of media literacy. Academics talk about it a lot. It's taught in courses at Fresno State and Bakersfield College and beyond. But what does it actually mean to the layperson out there who's listening to us right now?
Well, I think what we suggest with media literacy is for news consumers to understand how media work and for the media side, the media outlets, to understand their readers a little better, their readers, their listeners, their viewers. Excuse me, since coming from the newspaper background, I speak readers, but to the news consumers, I guess is a better term. So we want people to understand what we do and how we do it and why we do it. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. There hasn't been a lot of transparency over the years in media, and I think that has led to some of this distrust. Part of this is driven by politics. People on one side or the other of the political spectrum believe that you're writing certain stories or presenting certain facts because you want to either boost a candidate or boost a side or hurt another side. And that's generally not the case. I mean, we had our opinions on our opinion pages, but the news is supposed to be as objective as humanly possible.
Given the way digital trends have greatly multiplied the number of media organizations, and I use that term in a very loose sense, from bloggers to media aggregators to even outright just fake sites that just write up stories just to get clicks and have no basis in fact at all. Is the the term itself, media, almost a challenge right now to lump everything into one perspective. What might be a part of the media to one person might not be a part of the media to another.
Yeah, and it is a challenge, Joe. And what we want to do at the Institute is bring all forms of media in, bloggers and news sites and digital sites, mainstream media, and all versions of that, and bring them together and find the common ground, find the challenges, find ways that we can to rebuild that trust. This is a work in progress, but I think that we are on that leading edge here at Fresno State of looking for a solution. And I think if we can all sit down and talk about this over a long period of time, have seminars and speakers, listen to news consumers, that we can find some solutions.
So you mentioned seminars, things like that. Tell me a little more about the specifics as they are today, at least what you can tell us publicly about where this is going at Fresno State.
Well, we have three main ideas. Education about the issue, research, because we're going to do faculty research on the issue and have stipends for folks, and then outreach. We're going to actually reach into the K-12 schools. Fresno County Office of Education is being very helpful. They're going to work on creating a news literacy module for high school reading and composition students that would be available to teachers. So we're going to do that. We're going to have seminars. We'll have programs. We may bring in a major keynote speaker. Then we may spend the day with breakout panels. We'll probably have two each semester and maybe a summer program. So we want to be as visible and as active as possible. As executive director, I'll write a blog. I'll have guest writers be part of that blog. So we're going to try to reach out in all forms of media.
Jim, we have about a minute left. Okay. Before we go, both of us have been on these panels over the last year and a half or so talking about fake news, and we always get questions from members of the audience. If you had one thing that you can impart, sort of a takeaway for people who are concerned about, you know, whether they can trust what they're seeing on social media or on some website, maybe what would be one takeaway that you'd like to impart to those people?
Well, the internet is one of the problems, but it's also one of the solutions. So Google or whatever search engine you use, check out a story. See if it is printed in other media. See if there's only one site and a site that you may not recognize. And if it's that, then you should be cautious.
All right. Again, Jim Boren, the new executive director of Fresno State's Institute for Media and Public Trust, longtime editor of the Fresno Bee, in this new career back at Fresno State. Jim, best of luck to you, and we'll be very excited to share news about these events as they come forward.
Great. Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's population is projected to age rapidly in the coming decades. By the year 2030, adults over 65 will outnumber children under 18, according to the latest data from the state's Department of Finance. Today, seniors over 65 make up 14% of the population, but that number will increase to 23% over the next 11 years. And according to the National Council on Aging, 1 in 10 Americans over age 60 have experienced some form of elder abuse. Yet estimates suggest only 1 in 14 cases are actually reported to authorities. June 15th is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And here to tell us more is USC Professor Kathleen Wilbur with the Leonard Davis School of Gerontology. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you.
Kathleen, I want to start out here with the basics. When it comes to the perpetrators of elder abuse, who are we talking about here?
So when we talk about elder abuse, we're talking primarily about people in a position of trust, somebody that the older adult knows, family, friends, neighbors. And that's a distinction from elder fraud, which I can talk about as well, but that's, you know, the telemarketing calls and the strangers and those kinds of activities. But elder abuse, we're talking about problems in families and neighborhoods and in communities, tragically.
And what types of abuse are we talking about here? Certainly physical abuse is one that immediately comes to mind, but also there's sexual abuse, emotional abuse. Tell me about what are the different things that fall under this heading.
So we have conflict kinds of abuse, which you've just mentioned, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional or psychological abuse. And for some portion of older adults who need help with caregiving, we have caregiver neglect. And then there's financial exploitation. And somebody can be a victim of one of these types of abuse, but often they go together. And they have somewhat different kinds of causes, profiles, and pictures. So caregiver neglect can happen with a well-intended family member who just can't manage because of the, you know, the burden and the complexity and the difficulties and lack of support. Or it can be somebody who is intentionally neglecting an older adult who needs help. It's a complex, tragic problem. We're learning a lot more about it, but we're still in the very early phases of really understanding the dynamics and what happens and why.
How has that understanding changed over the years?
Well, first of all, I'll talk about a problem. We know more about what elder abuse is. We know that it happens a lot. As you said, about 1 out of 10 older adults is a victim annually. We don't really have a good handle on what to do about it, especially how to prevent it, how to support families, how to educate people so that it becomes much rarer and not, you know, highly prevalent, 1 out of 10 older people. So we're learning more about the family dynamics and the types of things that happen and why. I think it also falls into a context of family violence. So it's not just older adults that are abused, but we can learn from intimate partner violence and, sadly, child abuse. And there are some things that are working in those areas of family violence that perhaps will work with preventing and addressing abuse for older adults. But we're not there yet. We're just in the beginning phases of understanding what's happening and how to fix it.
You mentioned financial abuse and fraud. Tell me a little more about the scope of the problem when it comes to finances.
Actually, financial abuse is one of the most common types of elder abuse. And it can happen in several ways. It can happen through kind of a, you know, somebody just gets into grandma's checking account and borrows money or takes it without permission. But there's also a type of abuse where the person gets the older adult to agree. So it's called undue influence. And they talk the older adult into giving them more and more money. Sometimes it's thought of as a loan, or the person, for whatever method used, really gets the older adult to give them money. It's very hard to address that because, you know, people look at it and say, well, you took out a reverse mortgage on your home and gave this person hundreds of thousands of dollars. What were you thinking? So that can be a really insidious, complex, difficult area. And especially, you know, as people get into trouble with addiction or gambling or debt, or, you know, they sometimes also can talk themselves into it. Well, I need it. Grandma doesn't need it. So it's complex. It's tragic, and in a way, a little bit of a reflection on our society that this happens.
You mentioned how this should be viewed in the continuum of other domestic violence or abusive relationships. Is there a link between the two in some way? If we see a history of this type of behavior in one area, it spills over to abuse with senior citizens?
Yes, there are several links. One is that the physical and psychological and sexual, the conflict kinds of abuse, can be intimate partner violence in older age. Maybe the partners were engaging in physical or psychological abuse at a younger age. It continues into older age. Sometimes you have families where this is more the norm. And then you also have children who are victims of adverse experiences in early life, who maybe are more prone to some of these problems because they weren't addressed. So there's a link with family violence, there's a link with child abuse, and at the same time, there are distinctions. So caregiver neglect, most adults under the age of 65, not all, but most are not in a caregiving, care-receiving relationship. That increases because of some of the chronic diseases associated with older age. So caregiver neglect is more apt to be an elder abuse or adults with disability issue. By the same token, financial abuse, I guess you can see it in children, but children don't usually have financial means. So those are some of the distinctions and the complexity of elder abuse, that it cuts across all these kinds of areas.
A few years ago, the California Senate Office of Oversight and Outcomes reported that 13% of all complaints to the California Office of the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman involved abuse, gross neglect, or exploitation in nursing homes and facilities of that nature, over twice the national rate of 5%. How significant is that portion of this problem in the skilled nursing facilities that are out there that care for people who may have dementia or other physical ailments that have them out of the home setting?
I think it's very significant. There hasn't been a lot of broad-based research, but the World Health Organization just published a paper looking worldwide at abuse in facilities and found a really high rate of both providers who acknowledged that they had abused and older adults and their family members who said that they had been victims of abuse. So I think this is an area that hasn't received much attention. There are reports through the ombudsman, and those are important and important to pay attention to. I think there's a lot under the radar there. And I want to just say, too, that many facilities and providers are doing an outstanding job, and it's a really difficult role, but we really need to go after the bad actors and the bad apples and understand this problem should not be tolerated.
How can the state or you're saying this is a global problem as well. How can governments or regulatory agencies better address this situation? You said that a lot of it is under the radar right now. Are there any best practices out there? How do you try to solve something like that, especially when in many cases there might not be a witness to the violence and the victims might not be able to testify or explain what happened?
That's a really good and important question, and I think we have to make people more aware. We have to help them be willing to step forward. We have to help people understand that this is not acceptable and that it needs to be addressed. And again, I think what you have is the majority of providers, facility-based care, are really good and excellent and trying hard. And so the other part of it is to identify the bad actors, but not paint everyone with the same brush. And family members who have a family member in a facility need to be paying attention. They need to go there. Research suggests that if there's someone paying attention, there's much less likelihood of a problem happening.
We've mentioned a couple of times this long-term care ombudsman. I want to ask you a little more about that program and how that works, and then talk some more about other resources that are out there. But how does the long-term care ombudsman program work in California?
So it's a county-based program, and it is based on volunteers who are then supervised by an organization. They receive reports of problems in facility-based care and skilled nursing facilities, and they go in, and their role is really to try to address the problem. They don't come with sanctions. That's really not what they do. But they are eyes on the ground, and they take reports of abuse and they investigate.
What other sorts of resources are there in California counties or across the state for people who might have an adult in their family who they suspect might be the victim of abuse, neglect, or any of the things we've talked about today?
So in facilities, the ombudsman would be the place to call initially, and then they can link to other as well. In community-based care, and actually I'm much more familiar with that, it's Adult Protective Services. There's a statewide hotline that people can call. There's also Adult Protective Services is in every county, so each county will have an Adult Protective Service line. People can find that, make a call, make an anonymous report. Adult Protective Services will go into the home and investigate and follow up. But your listener should know that older adults have the right to autonomy and self-determination. So Adult Protective Services can say, we're concerned about this. If the older adult says, I'm not, I'm fine, go away, then that's what happens. And that's not a bad thing at all. All of us want to have right to self-determination and autonomy. So you've got that as an important value that kind of is above the other issues. Right to autonomy, self-determination, older adults making their own decisions, except if they have dementia and Alzheimer's disease or related cognitive functioning problem.
Are prosecutors across the state spending enough time on these sorts of issues and bringing individuals suspected of this to justice? What do we know about the state of elder abuse prosecutions? I guess it's a subjective thing to say whether they're spending enough time on it, but what do you know about the state of criminal penalties and enforcement on this issue?
It's a very difficult crime to prosecute because if an older adult has capacity, then with financial abuse in particular, it's kind of like, well, why did you give the person the money or the Rolex or the car or something? If they don't have capacity, then they're really not a good witness, and it becomes complicated. We did some research looking at a model of multidisciplinary teams that include prosecutors, law enforcement, adult protective services, and found about an 8- to 9-fold increase in prosecution. So when the team members who were involved with investigating the case got together and really weighed the evidence and looked at it, then they were able to put together cases and move forward. This was in Los Angeles County, but I would assume that would be true in other areas as well. But it's very, very difficult often to prosecute these kinds of cases, and they really are hidden and kind of away from public view.
Before we go, is there also a problem sometimes with the victims of elder abuse who do have their mental faculties intact, who might not be willing or ready to tell someone else about what happened to them, either through pride or protecting a family member, someone they raised, their own children? Is that also part of the complexity of this story?
Absolutely. That's a really, really important point, because sort of what are the options? Do you really want to have your family member be sent to jail because of this? And sometimes family members do, but most often that's not a good remedy. People might be ashamed, sort of, how could I let this happen to me? Or also ashamed that, you know, it's the dirty linen of the family. We don't want this exposed. So we talked to a number of older adults who told us things that make a lot of sense. They don't want their grandson to go to jail. They don't want this to kind of blow up. They don't want to lose the relationship that they have with an important person over this, or it's an embarrassing thing. So I think there's a number of reasons that people don't do this. Also, we have pretty heavy-handed solutions. So one of the things is to look for better remedies, prevention, education, helping families kind of turn this around if they're going down the path, helping people understand why this is a bad thing to do, and to make that part of our culture. I think it's those are all really important things that we need to move towards to reduce the likelihood that this will happen.
You can find links to some of the elder abuse resources we've talked about today on our website at kvpr.org. June 15th is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. We've been talking with Professor Kathleen Wilbur with the Leonard Davis School of Gerontology at the University of Southern California. Kathleen, thanks so much for taking the time today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for addressing this important and growing problem.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Central Valley has a rich literary tradition spanning generations. From Saroyan to Levine to Arax, journalists, poets, novelists, and essayists have all found great inspiration in the Valley's soil, the people of diverse backgrounds who call this place home, and the good and bad elements that make the region unique. The connection often extends even after a writer leaves the area, as is the case with our next guest, acclaimed novelist Steve Yarbrough. Around a decade ago, Yarbrough left his teaching position with Fresno State's Creative Writing Program to take a job at Emerson University in Boston. However, the San Joaquin Valley hasn't left him. His new novel, The Unmade World, is set in part in Fresno, as well as Eastern Europe. It explores how lives from dramatically different places converge and intertwine amid the tumult of global events. Steve Yarbrough joins us now. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to talk to you.
In the book, your character Sandy is talking about a drive home to the valley from a weekend in Carmel, and she tells her husband, "Every time I leave Fresno, I fall in love with California. In Fresno, I only love you." And you follow that up with a great line, "That didn't seem like such a bad state of affairs then, and it didn't seem bad now." Does that sort of sum up the good and bad of your time here in the Valley?
Well, though that point of view character's wife is Polish, like mine is, she's not based on my wife at all. But my wife did come from a very, very different place. She's from northern Poland, which has a really lush sort of environment like the one I come from in Mississippi. And I think she never really felt at home in that landscape. And I have to admit that it took me myself a long time to get used to it. Finally, we solved the problem by buying a house where I told a lot of people about half of the trees in Fresno seemed to be in my backyard. So that made a difference for us and helped us feel a little bit more at home there. The thing is that for me, Fresno was all about people, and I probably have more friends there than anywhere else on earth. So in the sense that I never quite felt at home in the landscape, but I felt at home with the people I cared about. So, yeah, I guess that does kind of sum up my own experience.
As a novelist, when you settle down in a new place, whether it's to live or to visit, whether it's Massachusetts or Fresno or Poland, are you consciously seeking to pick out new things, to pick up a little bit from here, a little bit from there? So is it more intentional or is it more passive when it comes to absorbing what makes a place and the people there unique?
I would say that it's more passive. I think I read a scene in an earlier novel where a character's been living in a place for many years and he's out taking a walk with his wife and he points at a nearby house and says, "Oh, look, there's a new roof there." And she says, "That roof's been there for 10 years. I'm not necessarily the most observant person in the world, but I do think that things sort of work their way inside me eventually. And for me, I never go anywhere thinking I'm going to write about this place, but it does feel like some places speak to me, sometimes almost immediately. For instance, there's a passage in this new novel that's set in an unnamed town in the Hudson Valley. And I've really only been to the Hudson Valley twice, but I remember being out one night in a mild snowstorm in this particular town and just having a moment where I thought, I'm going to use this setting. Generally, it doesn't happen like that. It takes me years to really start thinking of a place and as a fictional setting. And sometimes, too, I have to leave the place as I left Mississippi before I can really write about it. And I think that seems to have happened with Fresno, because though it figured just sort of glancingly in a couple of my other books, it wasn't really a fictional landscape for me when I lived there.
Tell me a little more about that process, whether it's in regards to Fresno or to Mississippi. How does that distance help from the writer's perspective?
Well, I can tell you how it helped in terms of my relationship to Mississippi, and it really only happened when I moved to Fresno, because I still have a Southern accent. Virtually every day of my life, of the 21 years that I lived in Fresno, somebody would ask me where I was from. And until I moved there, I really had never thought very much about where I was from. It was, you know, I grew up in Mississippi, and that was the world to me. But when someone asks you that every day, I think it's natural that you yourself start asking, you know, well, where am I from? What is unusual about the place, and what has made me unusual to others by virtue of coming from that place? During the years that I lived in Fresno, every time I went to Eastern Europe, and that was, you know, more often than not, we went every year, when somebody would ask me, where are you from? It just seemed to me I could answer this question any number of ways. Sometimes I said I'm from Fresno, California. Sometimes I said I live in California, but I'm from Mississippi, and so on. So I think that my relationship to place is always in flux. When I lived in Fresno, very often something would happen that I would just find maddening. At the same time, during the years that I was occasionally going down to L.A. and doing some screenwriting for Disney, boy, if somebody made a joke about Fresno, it would just drive me crazy. I'd get really, really defensive. So I think that when you get a connection to a place and you feel like it's yours, at least yours enough that you might write about it, your feelings are likely to be complex. You see the good, you see the bad, but ultimately what you're saying when you write about it is, okay, I want to spend some time with you now.
That's a great sentiment. This book tells stories of lives and a world unraveling, yet you also look how people pick up and move on in their own ways on new trajectories. Do you think that offers a similar sort of hope at a national and a societal level?
Yeah, I do, and I won't sugarcoat my notions about where we are right now. I think that, from my perspective anyway, as a country, we're in a very difficult place. And if you look at my wife's country, Poland is in a very difficult place. And it really does occasionally feel to me like, wow, our society is pulling itself, you know, apart at the seams, and the world seems to be doing it. But, you know, you don't have to be a historian to realize that this country and the world have been through difficult periods before. And I mean, my dad lived through World War II. And we're talking about death and destruction on a vast scale there. So I think we'll get through it. I think you always have to try to take the long view. It's easier, from my perspective, when you're 25 or 30. I'm 61 now, and I think I could have come through this time a little bit easier when I was 40. I don't think it would have bothered me on a day-to-day basis as much as it does right now.
We're talking with novelist Steve Yarborough about his new book, The Unmade World. Your book touches on the unrest in Eastern Europe, touches on the 2016 presidential election. For some novelists, the writing process is really drawn out over years and years. You're getting very topical with this novel. What's your process like? Do you set out to try to be very timely, or was this just situation where the circumstance presented itself to do something that was very contemporary in that sense?
No, I've never set out to be timely. This novel was was unusual in that I wrote it fairly fast. And really, you know, I had floundered around for a little while. I had written another book that I took it all the way to the end, and it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't everything I hoped it would be. And I had already published a lot of books, and I thought, I'm just going to set this one aside, and I'm going to go into something else. And once I got started on it, the storms were sort of gathering in both Eastern Europe and in the U.S., and I was actually writing a lot of that novel during the primary campaigns of 2016. And I finished the novel in Poland, where wide-scale protests against the peace government were going on, and I was taking part in quite a few of them with my wife. So it just felt very immediate. You know, it was like writing in real time. So this novel was unusual for me. The one I'm working on now is set mostly in the past. So this was a one-time thing, I think.
You mentioned the process of setting aside that other novel. How hard was that for you? Is the internal critic the toughest one?
No, my wife is the toughest one. And she's always the first one. And she's the one that I listen to when I might not listen to anybody else. She knows my work inside out. And by the way, she's got a new essay collection out that I'm very, very proud of. I think she's a heck of a writer. But, you know, she's honest with me, and she saw some problems with this book that I set aside from the very beginning, but I was hard-headed. I took it all the way to the end, and I guess the surest notion or the surest reflection of my own opinion of it is that it was rough when I decided not to do anything with it, and I talked to my agent about it, but I've never regretted it. It is in a box in the basement, and if somebody came and said right now, oh, we want to publish that novel, I wouldn't let them do it.
You were not only very current in addressing the global political climate, but some other issues in the book. One of them, sort of the seedy underbelly of college athletics. You come from Mississippi. Football is king in the South, college football especially. And you write about the fictional University of Central California football team. Tell me about factoring that into this story.
Well, one thing I should tell you is that I went to college on a football scholarship myself. And I played 2 years and then thought, no, I think I need to get serious about academics. But football has always mattered to me. And if I'm to be honest, I have to say that it had a lot to do with my being a writer, because I learned how to get knocked down and get back up. That's useful for a writer. I do still love the game. Since I moved to Massachusetts, I've become a huge Patriots fan. I almost never watch college football anymore. During my years in Fresno, I was a huge fan of the Fresno State football team after Pat Hill became the coach. You know, he raised the team's GPA by almost a full point within a year and a half. And if you had players in your class, you could just tell the difference with them. So nothing that happened at Fresno State during my years really has anything to do with that fictional football team. Now, if you follow college athletics, you know that there have been a huge number of scandals involving coaches, not just football coaches, but basketball coaches around the country. Right around the time I left Fresno State, there were two or three big ones. I remember one involving Rick Pitino, another one involving Bobby Petrino, Hugh Freeze more recently at Ole Miss, where I went to school. And it just kind of got to the point that it turned my stomach, and I found myself thinking, okay, really, I'm an educator in college, and You know, as I said, I love the game, but I do think things have gotten badly sort of misarranged in terms of where some universities' priorities lie. So that's something I do feel pretty strongly about.
Again, our guest today, novelist Steve Yarborough, the former Fresno State professor, now at home in Boston, where he teaches at Emerson University. His new novel, The Unmade World, is set in part in Fresno as well as Eastern Europe. It explores how lies from dramatically different places converge and intertwine amidst the tumult of global events. You can find that book wherever books are sold. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to reconnect after all these years.
It's great to talk to you, Joe. And you may notice that I still have a 559 area code on my cell phone.
Good to know that there's a little bit of the Central Valley still with you all the way there in Boston. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. You can find our podcast and audio archives at kvpr.org. And you can find us tomorrow night. For our Kern County listeners, we're going to be holding an open house at Cafe Smitten in downtown Bakersfield. We invite you to join us from 5 to 7 p.m. Meet our news team and have a cup of coffee on us. Again, that's Wednesday night at Cafe Smitten in Bakersfield. More information at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Mark Benjamin, Carrie Klein, Christina Lopez, and Monica Velez. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.